Okay, I wanted to, what I want, some things were said yesterday, both by Johan, well, it was a question that Johan was asked, and also some of the things Mike Graham said. I thought it would be maybe useful to say a few things about the physics of pups and slugs and some of the confusion that I even see persisting until today. Because if you just don't work with these things, it's not obvious. So that's point one. And then I think in the general frame of this community needing to go to larger geometries, you know, the kind of thing Predrag talked about yesterday, although I have a different perspective on it, I thought we would talk a little bit about, I asked Mark to talk a little bit about interfaces and John to talk about localized structures, because just to put, you know, maybe get some discussion about what happens when you have turbulent and laminar together and what to do about some of these problems. So let me just explain. Let me just start with a really basic observation that about a pup, or I want to show what Johan had yesterday. He had, I'm going to draw it very small, well, I'll draw it thinner. He had one of these turbulent bands, and if you look at it edge on, the turbulence is has roughly this shape because one plate is moving one direction, one plate is moving the other, is shear, and it shears the turbulence itself. Now, it's not the shape of this I want to talk about. That was the point of what he was saying. But I just want to emphasize something about these structures, which is that individual parcels of fluid are continually flowing into this bit of turbulence and then back out the other side. So there's a constant conversion of from laminar to turbulent and back to laminar. That's going on continually as this thing persists, and it's going the opposite way down the bottom.
Entrainment, right, is the word.
Yeah, entrainment. Okay? Thanks, Mark. And likewise with a pup, I'll get on to describing a pup in just a second. There's a constant entrainment of fluid here, and then a relaminarization out the backside. And
so there's some waffling confusion about the word leading and trailing.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to get to. Although I'm not going to use those words for a vowel. So here's my take on, there's a very simple way to understand what's going on, I believe. Maybe we'll find out if that's true or not. So I want to start with a pipe at Reynolds number 5,000, just to pick a big number, a biggish number for this community. And so you're going to have turbulence. This thing's going to be full of turbulence, these streaks, and et cetera. And we know basically what the balance is that goes on here. And let me draw a shear profile. So that's the mean profile. And we know, I'm going to call it the radial direction from the wall, y, and we know that these are then the fluctuations. I'll put primes on them just so it's clear. That's the production, that's your production term. And it's this variation in the shear profile together with the fluctuations that have to conspire to. This is your mechanism by which you're extracting energy from the mean shear and putting it into fluctuations. Am I correct? Have I made a mistake? It's good. I think we're good. So far, good. All right. So this is no. I just worry about when I start talking about real fluids, then I sometimes worry. All right. So that's the idea. So this is the dominant thing that's really going on here. Now,
can you call this P,
Dwight? No, I'm going to want P to be the okay. I will call this P, but I want P to be the integrated the sectionally integrated form of this. If you want, it's integrate over diameter of that and call that P. Good with that? I just want to integrate that over the diameter to get, because that's what I'm going to use P for. But now I need to, unfortunately, well, I drew that in a bad place. All right, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this turbulence and I'm going to cut it here. And I'm going to put upstream, I'm just doing weight, the laminar profile. Okay, so we know that if for the same mass flux here and there, this has more kinetic energy because it has higher velocity in the center. So this moving at higher velocity, it has higher kinetic energy. So now what happens here is an interface develops. And then this, now we're getting to the part that really the part I want to explain. So this, the way you should think of it is this turbulence, this looks like fuel. And that's what this is. You know, this is a flame front, and it wants to move into that fuel. That's exactly what it wants. And if you look at, I'm going to have to erase this, unfortunately. Bofang Song did these calculations just recently and improved on what's written in Wignansky et al. Many of you will know that paper from the early 70s. Is he finds that here, not surprisingly, production exceeds dissipation. And there's another region on kind of exaggerated scale. So that takes place for about 8 diameters, I believe, something like that. Then you have a region where actually production falls below dissipation. And then here in the core, you have production is equal to dissipation, and you're in equilibrium. Okay. Now, if you look at this, this structure, this is the so-called trailing edge of a slug, but it's the leading edge of a front. This is a flame front moving that way. But this mean flow is pushing everything that way. So what happens if you look in space and time at this thing, what you'll see is you'll see your front moving like that, downstream. If you put it, all right, I'll leave off the other front for. Now that's a bad way to look at it. You're much better off looking at it in a frame of reference. In which the fluid is on the whole stationary. If we all did our experiments in pipes the way you do plain Couette flow, if we just held the fluid fixed at the ends and just slid the pipe, there would be a lot less confusion about these problems, because then you'd see this front moving the way it really is moving. It's moving upstream, and so you'd see this front moving this way. It moves upstream. Okay. Now, I'm almost there. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to crank down the Reynolds number. And what's going to happen is, and at some point, my little balance equation, it can no longer be satisfied. You're going to increase the dissipation, you're increasing the turbulence. A lot of things are going to change. But at some point, you're going to fail to be able to satisfy this, and this is going to collapse. The core of the slug will collapse. I haven't drawn the other end of it. I don't want to worry about that right now. This will collapse. However, this will still be happy. You'll still be able to have this upstream front, also known as trailing edge. And so that's what gives rise to this puff. It's the thing I already drew there. So that part's still there, and then it just dies. Right? So our flame front is still there. There's our fuel. Our fuel is still there. And our front is still moving. It's just that it burns up all its fuel. You get a distorted shear profile. Production can't keep up with dissipation, and it distorts. So you just have this part of the thing, and just not that part. It's simple.
Is that because the trailing part of the puff really goes below the production, goes below the dissipation, or is it because the trailing edge catches up with this deficit?
No, this if you start with something like this in a pipe. Long, and then you turn this will just collapse.
I mean, how long is that reach on the second reach, the second one, the deficit one?
So the whole thing, it cut. No, actually, I said 8 diameters. This whole thing is roughly from here to there. Is roughly. He's going to look it up exactly. Mark can put up the slide and just know where we compute these things exactly. He's going to tell you the.
It's like four diameters, the first one, and 2 diameters, the second one.
Two diameters, so it's quite short. Yeah. The second one is shorter. And it's not that it.
No, four diameters, it's about 4 diameters.
I mean, it's not that the second part gets longer, but the Reynolds number decreases.
No.
That's right. And this imbalance is not very, very strong.
Yeah, but it's, yeah. Okay, so let me just say something. So the thing is, again, so what you see, and this is, again, causes a lot of, if you look at this thing, because advection dominates, if you do an experiment and you watch this thing, what you'll see then is you'll see this upstream front, and you'll see this downstream front moving down the pipe, and you look and you see this one arrives first, I'll call that the leading edge, and this one arrives behind, I'll call that the trailing edge. But that, you know, this is just the ashes coming out of the flame. Look, nobody would be confused. I was going to go buy one next door, but they didn't sell them. If I lit a little Bunsen burner or lighter, it will look like this. And not by accident. It's the same. You know, this is Poiseuille flow, which is what comes out of a Bunsen burner. There's a flame sitting on that, and then there's the top of the flame. And nobody's surprised about why that looks that way or where the flame really is coming from. But yet the equivalent thing here causes immense confusion, because it moves the wrong way. This thing is moving upstream. It's moving upstream. It's just all being blown. It's a flame moving upstream. That's really my main message here. And so if you look at this one, in fact, I'll plot it on the same plot. I'm going to plot this one over here now. You see, what happens is you would perceive this one to be moving faster. And what it's really doing is it's moving more slowly upstream. So it's moving faster downstream, but it's a flame out problem. Here the flame is really strong. It's beginning to weaken. When this puff goes away, which is the last bit of turbulence you see before you can't get any turbulence at all, it's a flame out. It's just a flame out problem. Okay? And then
the second picture is smaller angles.
Yes. Oh yes, sorry. Let's put it at 2,000. So I've increased viscosity, so I've gotten rid of this. I specifically do not want to talk for a long time, because I want to let other people talk, and it'd be nice if we had a little discussion maybe about these things generally. So I will make just a few other points. One is that you can ask, and this is what Mark talked about, you can ask what happens on the downstream side of a slug, and there are two cases. Let's review. Mark's going to show you movies in a second. And you can either have this case here where you always have a strong upstream front. Then you can have it spatially extending, but it can still have it a front like this where, and I didn't say, but I'll say now, fluid particles here are continually going through this object. And likewise here, you can have fluid particles flowing in and becoming turbulent, being entrained. And here you have fluid particles that were turbulent. If you just follow that little bit of fluid, it comes out the back and relaminarizes, sometimes called a reverse transition. And this only happens for a relatively small Reynolds number range. Do you get those kind of slugs? At higher Reynolds number, you have two flame fronts. This is entraining fluid. This is entraining fluid. So if you look at individual particles, they're both flowing in. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's because this is expanding relative to the mean speed. So if I plotted that one on here, I would have, well, it's going to, on this one, I'd have the upstream front. I'd have the two fronts like this. Anyway, it's overrunning. This front is overrunning the downstream fluid, so it's overtaking it and entraining fluid on both sides. And Mark will show you a movie of that.
So the terminology, is that pretty universal that people say the leading edge means the left?
People mean this by the leading edge and that by the trailing edge. I never use those words. I just find it causes immense confusion. Let me just say, with regard to what Mike was saying and just the bigger picture, that, see, the thing is, in real intermittent flow, what you will find is, if I take... Well, I'll just draw yet another picture. And I think it's particularly true of the kind of thing Mike was referring to, because he's got patches, you know, he's got these quiescent regions where his turbulence kind of fades out because of the polymers. And, well, look, you got here, quiescent, you got turbulence. Now, his turbulence is weaker than what I'm talking about there, but nevertheless, it's there. And so you expect, let me just say, in a Newtonian, in a pipe, you can see these events. Mike referred to this. I mean, the quiescent phases exist even in the Newtonian case. You don't have to put any polymers to get that. If you look here, what you will see almost invariably is a front. This will intensify. Well, it has to, because this shear profile will, as soon as you come out of the turbulence, will begin to recover a little bit. It'll become a little bit more intense, and that acts like a fuel source for this. And you can see very clearly a signature of that. If you just look at the turbulence intensity, it'll be low. It'll go up higher than in the core, and it'll do this. And if you look at the plots Mike showed yesterday, now this is a function of space. Now, of course, the whole thing is moving downstream. So if you look at it as a function of time, you see this. And these are the things Rob Poole showed. So this overshoot almost surely is one of these fronts. That's my take on that. So anyway, there. That's I. A lot of people, you know, people who work on these problems all have their own way. You know, who seriously work on it, all have their own way of coming to grips with this reference frame and which way things are going. They all have their way of saying it. I think this is a particularly useful way to say it, but I think it hopefully it clears up some of the. Oh, Mike, you missed your laminar phases. Your laminar phases, your plot.
You have There's to, a video.
Watch the tape. Watch the tape.
Oh.
yeah. Then just I don't want to spend more time on it. But let me just say that two other things. One is that. You know, my claim is that these puffs are just like action potentials. I mean, we use all the same terminology, the kind of thing that Roman has been talking about with his excitable media, although he's talking about two space dimensions and not one. But it's nevertheless the same thing. I mean, that, you know, we all know a neuron has a resting state, even if you don't know much about this, that, you know, and then they fire. Well, when they fire, they do this. And there's this thing that propagates down the action potential. Well, that's the puff propagating up the pipe. Is that it flows downstream. And in fact, if you look at this, and it's my claim, I didn't have the guts to do it. It's my claim that I could take a signal from an action potential, relabel it kinetic energy versus space, publish it in JFM as a puff, and it would go right through. The referees would accept it, it would get published. And then I could say, ha, ha, ha. But I don't think, but why? You know, why do that? Why get myself in trouble? But they're just, they look, you know, certain ones anyway look just virtually identical. You can put them on top of each other. And then the other thing is that I won't say anything about now, which is that this process from which you go to this, to where you begin to expand, you're going to get these laminar holes are going to show up when you start to do this. And that's the basic mechanism which gives rise to the percolation kind of problem that Nigel will talk. I talked a little bit about in my Blackboard talk on Monday, and that Nigel will talk about next week. I mean, my view is the dominant mechanism is what I just erased. It's the mean shear, and the mean shear and the fluctuations. Nigel has a different take on it, but we just disagree about that. Okay, so there. I wanted to say that, and then I think I guess the natural thing is Mark to talk a little bit. He's going to talk a little bit more in detail, but not for very long. Nobody's going to talk for very long. If we can just discuss things about the interfaces, and then John can tell something about localization, staking, and so forth. Is that good? And
yeah, I think you have said most of the important things. I can show a couple of movies.
Yeah, you can definitely show some movies though. We've got some nice movies.
Probably my daughter will call on me before I can start. Just give it a shot.
You can sit in the chair.
I can just pick her and tap in the arm.
I have an orange for our driver.
The phone clock is not really eating oranges yet. Actually, I'm showing now. I showed in my talk during the conference, but not all of you were there. And some of you were there, and maybe were not mentally there also, so it's good for me.
Yeah, I might have to switch buttons, I think. I think there's a computer one, computer two. Yeah. There's a block on the lens.
Oh.
Okay, I'm not showing my screen. So do you put any input? Yeah, probably.
Computer
up or down? Let's see. Computer. Yeah, computer. There we go. And then do I have to press enter? Enter.
Okay, looks good.
Yes. Okay, great. Wow.
Your computer is working. Yeah, computer is working.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so let's have a movie and see these things that Dwight was talking about. So that this is the weak slack where we have this upstream front that generates a turbine that feeds the flame front that feeds on the mean shear here, the strong mean shear we have here, and that's this front which is essentially a continuous laminarization. And actually it is growing, so it's a slack. But if we just look at these two parts, they are essentially a path. You have a path with a regular turbulent flow like in Blasius' law in the middle. And I'll talk, I think it's important to have a look at the properties of this turbulent flow, and I'll say a couple of things, because I have the feeling sometime in the community we look at models, we look at exact coherent structures, and I think it's important we connect to statistical properties of turbulence, and we can talk also to people outside our community.
What is creating those vortices at the leading edge? I mean, where are they?
What is the leading edge now? Is the downstream or the upstream?
The upstream.
Because that would be the trailing edge. I'll talk about this later, but essentially a conversion from mean shear into vortices by, we'll talk about it. But
it's called the left side, the right side.
No, I think upstream is good. Upstream and downstream, it's very good. Because there's a flow direction, so.
It's always left to right.
Yeah, it's always left to right in our movies.
I mean, I know movies which are right to left. Very confusing.
Well, I think here it looks quite clear that if you look at the turbulent vortices, we are going from left to right. Anyway, that's the what happens at large Reynolds. That's what happens at larger Reynolds number. That's the 5,000 case that Dwight picked. Now, if you look at the two of them, you will see, in this case, both the turbulence is generated here and it goes to the inside of the flow, and also that's what happens on the downstream edge. So you can see a big change of character in the downstream edge or front as you change the Reynolds number. And if you look at what happens inside, again, that's just regular turbulence you would compute in short pipes.
So what are we looking at?
Well, that's the pipe. Flow goes from left to right. Black is laminar flow. This here is the measures the intensity of the turbulence by looking at the cross-sectional velocities. Okay. Yeah, so azimuthal and radial velocities. And that's here is lambda 2 for vortices.
So it's stronger and the two on the edges than the bulk. Turbulence intensity is higher on the edges.
Exactly. That's what Dwight was speaking about, that production exceeds dissipation.
Yeah.
So we have a strong peak here and here. And if you go back to the lower Reynolds number, you actually have this only on the upstream front. And that's this change of character that Dwight.
But this is a fixed reference frame. Or is this moving? What reference frame is
this? This is what you could call the center of gravity of the structure. No?
But let's make a quick comment. I think you actually mentioned that during the talk at the conference. I don't remember exactly, but the picture that Dwight drew on the board is somewhat misleading, because you don't have particles passing through one direction. You have particles passing
in both directions.
In both directions.
I'll speak about this later.
That's important, right? If you look close to the wall is moving in that direction. So the vorticity that we generate further down is actually transported away.
But if you see here in a frame moving with the fronts, all the turbulence goes to one side, even close to the wall.
And in the bulk picture, then it's really clear that you get a lot of vorticity near the wall, but there's almost nothing yet near the central line, right? So that part gets transported in the opposite direction, right? So the flow goes right, and the turbulence intensity it actually goes left, right? On the left.
Yes. Yeah. We would have to think about what frames of reference we are talking about.
It's a very small layer of relative.
But
that's important, right? So you have part of the fluid actually moving one direction.
You have a linearization entrainment at both fronts. You have both at both fronts.
He's going to show you that.
But the two fronts are very different. I mean, one is concave and the other is convex.
That's right.
Yeah, that's this part. When I took this part, that's motivated by the one-dimensional model in which you sort of integrate in the azimuthal and radial directions, and we don't care too much about shapes. But you are right. But I'll speak about this was motivated by the predictions of the 1D model that we can really verify in DNS and experiments. We can speak about the 3D structure. I'll speak about the 3D structure in a second.
Yeah.
And that's what the model sort of predicts of 1D. That's what you would see if you plotted this average quantity here, so average over azimuthal and radial, and you would get something like this.
Things in there.
Yeah, and that's what you are talking about. Actually, I just found out last week, experiments of Vignansky, and I look in detail last week, and you can see what you are talking about here. They collapse data of the shape of the two interfaces, and you find exactly this thing. The one is like this, and the other one also. Yeah, so in the radial direction, they are different interfaces.
What is this figure showing?
This figure is showing, I could take here sort of a place of the interface by setting a criterion and do averages. And then this would be the shape of the interface we would have at the back, but also at the front. They are equal at large enough Reynolds number. Yeah, that's exactly the interfaces that Dwight has shown.
If we were to define the coordinate transformation such that a parabola looks like a straight line, would two edges look straight then?
There is not really a parabola, no.
No, the parabola of Laminar, I'm thinking.
The interface has a different shape. But anyway, that's the motivation exactly to go from the 1D modeling to more what's happening in 3D.
What's in the vertical axis of Wiggy's experiment?
So what they did here is they do some measurements at different radial locations, and then they detect the position of transition to turbulence on the lamina.
Yeah, so what is that axis?
So that's the radial coordinate.
Yeah, that's the radial coordinate.
And that would be axial distance. Yeah, so they just make measurements here. The structure comes and say, okay, transition from laminar to turbulent. And they do this at different locations, and they see how the transition to turbulent is at different radial locations.
Okay, I mean, you're just saying that the shape of one interface and the shape of the other is
exactly the same.
Just in different sizes.
Okay. So in the case of this interface, turbulence would be here. In the case of this interface, turbulence is here. But the shape is the same. You wanted to say something?
No, I just got to hear
transpose that.
Yeah. Well, Dwight asked me to give this talk like
no.
A couple of hours ago. I had to pick up my daughter from the kindergarten and come back to the slides there. That's why I should change this figure. So, okay, let's try now to, yeah?
It's highly non-trivial fact. I mean, yeah. Break this image. Why should the interface be the same?
Why it should be radially the same, we have no idea or some idea, but why in average it should be symmetric, that from Dwight's model comes straight away.
I know, but the model doesn't agree with the three.
Well, the model averages over all this region, so you don't sort of, I guess, care. It does not describe the size of the turbulent structures. But the model captures all the speeds well and captures the main ingredients of the physics.
I
mean, if you don't look at
what that is,
just do this at really high Reynolds number, and then it becomes obvious. It doesn't. You know, the turbulence is going to entrain laminar flow very, very rapidly.
Not high Reynolds number.
Oh, well,
laminar flow.
Okay. Let's say 10,000. And the thing is that entrainment, of course, there's going to be locally the parabolic flow, which is going to essentially dictate the shapes of those. But whether you're moving into flow coming this way or you're overtaking it coming going that way, it's roughly the same thing.
No,
that's not obvious.
That's not obvious. I don't know.
If I told you that the speed of these things was symmetric about the mean speed, which it is nearly, mm-hmm. would that help?
No.
Why?
I want to know why you think of it as a frame, that's how you think. Why a frame that is moving basically through the wall is the same as a frame that is moving through the center of the channel. They're doing different things.
This thing is more or less propagating along the pipe at a constant speed, like a solid object, right?
Yeah, sure.
So then the velocity with respect to the solid object is much faster here than here, and things get deformed this way, right?
Yeah, but it's not actually the same. I mean, it's probably obvious. No, I mean, the velocity is not faster because it's a solid object, but the velocity is the same.
The velocity of the object, not, but the velocity of the fluid relative to the object, yes. Yes.
So, Mark, I mean, think about it this way. In one case, for one end, you're transporting momentum in one direction. On the other end, you're transporting momentum in the other direction. It it's not obvious that those two are symmetric processes.
It's definitely not obvious, yeah.
Right, so yes, I mean, when Mike is saying that the velocities are the same, I think it's not really, I mean, this is a result, it's not really a reason for anything for the symmetry.
But what does mean velocities are the same?
So the velocities of the in-frame, in the frame of reference moving into that slide, that it expands at the same velocity in both directions. I think, you know, it's an interesting result, but it doesn't prove anything. I mean, it would be nice to understand.
Doesn't prove anything, sure. Yeah, we are starting to look at the physics in detail. We can have a look at what will happen in this gallery.
I think at your movie up there, it looks different. One case, there is nothing near the wall, which is where the highest shear, but this is about here, but this is still where the highest shear is. So most of the production is near the wall. And in one place, near the wall, there is nothing. And in the other place, everything is near the wall. So, I mean, they are different, yeah. The fact that they are not different is very interesting, but it's not obvious to me.
Well, they are different in this. If they were identical, then it would be mirrored about this axis here. They are actually different.
But the fact
that the shape is the same.
That the two shapes agree, it is very interesting.
If you don't have a mean advection, like in Planckwedt, then you would have the. This would be reverted to the other side, and the effect of the mean advection is to.
No, that's not what you're plotting there. You're plotting there the trailing edge and then the upstream and then
I'm saying that if I did this for plane quad flow, I would get this shape here and then a shape symmetric on the other side. I guess we could agree on that
and
for plane quad flow.
On this side.
So that's what I'm plotting there. And in case of plane quad flow, I think it would be obvious to everybody that we would have something like this, right? And it would be reflection of symmetric because we have the symmetry in plane quad. You know what I'm saying? Because of in the pipe, the mean advection, the mean profile changes it this way. Why it should be exactly the same? I don't have an answer for this, really. I don't have an answer for this. I don't think anybody has. Actually, as I said, I just found out about this picture a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't have any time to think.
No.
I thought it was so interesting, I put it here.
No, Wiggy is very, very careful experimentally, so that's probably true.
Yeah, we have not computed that from our data. I'm sure it comes exactly the same. Yeah, so moving a little bit more into the analysis of turbulence, but still keeping in this 1D approach. So what we do is what Dwight mentioned, we integrate production and dissipation and transport in the pipe cross section, so we still get one-dimensional quantities. So that's the definition of turbulent kinetic energy. That's the equation for production and dissipation, so the equation of the turbulent kinetic energy. And we do this in a frame co-moving with the frog. So if we go back here, that would be the frame. Oops. So now we are either in this frame of reference, this remains fixed, or this here remains fixed. We do our production dissipation analysis. We don't do it in the frame down there. And then there comes the things that Dwight was talking about. So you have this strong production peak and a dissipation peak, which is delayed to the right. Yeah, so we are looking now at this interface here. And that's what you expect. You are able to extract a lot of energy from the strong mid-laminar shear you have and convert it to turbulent dissipations. Then you have convection terms that transport it towards the inside of the structure where they get dissipated. And this explains the delay of this signal. So zero is the peak, and you see the peak dissipation, it's delayed by a little bit here, delayed by one diameter. And then if you look at at this part for a path or for a slack at low Reynolds number, then you just see that it's production in equilibrium is nearly in equilibrium locally with dissipation, and the whole thing just dies away like decaying homogeneous isotropic turbulence.
This is one front. And that is.
This is the other front. That's for the weak case. Yeah, that's the case where the flow and downstream, it's essentially like a relaminarization into laminar flow.
That means what happens in the strong case?
In the strong case, I can put it here, I have as an extra slide. And in the strong case, what you see is the effect of the mirror symmetry that Dwight is speaking about and we're talking about here. Again, this is now integrated, but you can see that the same peak emerges, and these two pictures are essentially mirror symmetric, and actually at high Reynolds number, we believe they should be totally symmetric. Yeah, like this. Well, they may become totally symmetric. Definitely, as we increase the Reynolds number, this peak rises up and becomes more like the one in the left. And we see, again, very marked this delay between the peak production and the peak dissipation and the convection processes. OK, so this is all 1D analysis. We integrate on the cross-section. But now going back to the questions of Roman and Javier, what do we see as we look at things in a 3D way? And that's what we did for a path a few years ago. The work didn't get much attention. Maybe it's complicated to read. It's unusual, the stuff we do for our community, maybe more usual to Javier. But what we do is we study the path in a Lagrangian frame, moving with the interface, and we look at the local propagation velocity of the interface relative to the fluid. Then we can see fluid gets entrained or relaminarizes across the interface and exactly where this happens. So now we are looking at it locally in space, not just averaging. And what we did here, so we take a patch of isosurface of entropy. That's an arbitrary definition, but it's a way we can define this. So we define these interfaces as being an isosurface of a constant value of something, in this case, entropy. We call it laminar to one side and turbulent to the other side. And then by looking at this, at the velocity of the isosurface, we decompose it into this part relative to the fluid and then the velocity of the element.
I mean, when you say entropy, you mean entropy in some coarse-grained sense, because entropy was obviously the thing that you see there.
That's right, but we'll have a look at how the picture looks like, but that's not it's not in a coarse-grained sense. We'll see, it looks quite messy, and the integrals become quite difficult, and we have to resolve the turbulent scales very well, with much higher grids than we do normally, but we can have a look now. But the thing is that since now we have, in this Lagrangian frame, we can rewrite the entropy equation so that we exactly get the velocity of the area element of this interface relative to the fluid. Yeah, so this velocity, Vn, depending on the sign, will indicate if we are getting locally entrainment or relaminarization. Now I look at your faces and I realize why people don't pay attention to the paper. But essentially what it's good to, you can do the mathematics and so on and they're in the paper, but this quantity will tell you we have local relaminarization or local entrainment. And going back to Javier, how this should look like, so they look quite messy. Actually, these interfaces be the upstream interface, the downstream interface, have huge areas and look quite messy. And what I'm plotting here, the color map, is this local velocity that indicates entrainment or relaminarization. Yeah. And we can see, yeah?
The local velocity of that interface will not be horizontal, will be
working. It's in the normal, it's all in the normal direction with respect to the interface. So I wrote here Vn, that's normal to the area element, local at that point at the isosurface. It may be, it's not streamwise, but also the fluid, the decomposition uses also the local fluid velocity, which of course is also three-dimensional.
But then that capital V, this is what? This is the mean velocity of the interface, or the capital V?
The capital V is it's the same one, just we have the normal vector.
So
this is a scalar because it's only normal to the interface. If it goes along the interface, then nothing changes. It remains in the interface. Oh, I do have a problem now. Okay, you can discuss. I'll be back in a second. Anyway, I have to stop for
you. Is she being recorded?
You want to agree? We can. Speak first to the
volunteer. Who wants to take over?
John does.
Okay, well,
that's the point.
Did you take?
No, go ahead, Mike.
I take over, but what I would have to say is pretty orthogonal or indifferent. Maybe we should let this discussion play out.
The thing is, I can't describe.
You know,
I don't know what he's doing. I mean, this basically the same thing that people do for the turbine interface. And this is a turbine interface. And that depends about on where you put your threshold. That's why you want to know what he's doing.
Trying to communicate with our
city of Wall.
Was he going to bring the, I thought he was going to bring the baby back here.
That was a plan.
He's trying to defuse the baby.
Okay, so anybody, does anybody intend to come to the residence for a barbecue tonight who hasn't emailed me yet?
Hi,
this girl. 1, 2.
I told you.
Yeah, so I just want to add up those who haven't.
Okay.
Just 2.
I'm
3?
Come, but okay. I don't need to know that. I will just drop by.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay.
We'll see
how
So Mark,
yeah.
That holder is Marcus Holden?
That's Marcus Holden, yeah.
I mean, I know. Then roughly I know what he has.
Okay. So this is...
Not for this case, but for the case of the interface.
So interfaces in JETS are different because the quiescent flow has no mean shear, there's no mean strain or mean vorticity, whereas our laminar flow, at the outside of the interface, it has mean shear and mean vorticity.
How does he decide in this case what is the threshold that he uses for the...
We play a little bit with it and get more or less similar results. It has to be able to distinguish between, so if you pick it too high, then you get stuff everywhere. And we pick it low enough so that in a way that we have.
If you pick it too high, you make the thing smaller.
And you could plot the integrated one over the cross section, you get something like this for the path, right? And then you pick something like this. Now I should throw a horse. Anyway, the important thing that we learn out of here locally, and that's not surprising, here you get delaminarization because the particles are faster than the fluid particles are faster than the interface, and then at the walls you get entrainment, exactly as Roman suggested. And then for this interface here it's the opposite. Entrainment in the middle, delaminarization close to the walls. And in this case, the entrainment is zero in average because the size of the structure is constant.
I mean, what are the important terms? Because I know that Markus, what he does is break. Yeah, I mean, that breakdown.
And now you can take this velocity, this entrainment velocity, and decompose it in different. Huh, great. We can take it in different parts.
He's asking what the color map is of the horse.
doesn't look very colorful. So this is a nonlinear inertial term. Then we have a viscous term, which essentially destroys turbulence. And then we have this important term here. These are the linear interactions. So that's the gradient of laminar velocity profile, which would be our fuel we are burning. That's where our energy comes from. And the gradient of the perturbation velocity. Yeah, it takes the energy from it. And then also this part, radial transport of laminar vorticity is playing a role. Now, all these things are, these decompositions are pretty, so there's good mathematics and physics behind it. Now, what are some of the results when you do the analysis by fixing this surface, either surface of entropy, and doing the balances of different temps and Navier-Stokes and so on inside, writing the different contributions? Some observations. First, that the interfaces are very, very large in area, two orders of magnitude larger than the pipe area. Then that the local entrainment velocities of the turbulent of the patches of laminar flow into turbulence are very, very, very small. So for jets, they are on the order of the Kolmogorov velocity that was proposed for by Korsen a long time ago. So for, where the laminar part doesn't have shear or vorticity, here they are even much smaller. And then the important term, the one you are asking always, what is the term that generates this interface here that you have a transition from laminar to turbulent flow in the path? So here is this this linear interaction term. So what I wrote here, linear stretching of vorticity because of the mean profile, the shear in the mean profile, which we convert into turbulent fluctuations.
So, I mean, that's a vector. I mean, those two are the advective term. You're just moving the vortex around. But then viscosity has to be there somewhere because you're killing viscosity.
Well, the viscosity is key for the propagation speed. So what happens, and that's why the Kolmogorov scale comes in there. But for understanding how the path structure can extract energy from the laminar flow, that's the term that turns out to be key. So the and the terms are pretty horrendous. And that term, which is the combination of the gradient of the laminar velocity profile, so that's the mean shear we have in the laminar velocity profile, with the vortices that can extract energy from it. And that's the term that dominates the balance of this strong.
That's a very complicated way of writing omega S omega. The stretching term.
Well, stretching term of this combination of the laminar part, which would be Poisson flow, the parabolic flow, and the disturbance part on the parabolic flow.
But that's still the
it's not the turbulent mean, it's the laminar part in capitals and the disturbance part in lowercase. But this is really, I think, getting into this, I mean, one should read the paper.
I didn't know.
It takes some time, but that's the main findings. And also recalling that we have both randomization and entrainment at both interfaces, in this case, in the case of the buff. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
So, John, you want to talk, or maybe, I don't know, I have a question for people like you and Roman, and maybe you could talk, or something. I mean, Roman, you've computed localized structures in pipe flow. I guess other people have, Ashley's not here. Is there any connection between what you've computed and these interfaces, the kind of things that Mark showed and I was talking about? What do you think?
In some sense, yes, in some sense, no, right? So the stuff that we did was for the 3D flow, so you use the essential ingredient that you don't have the axial vorticity. And the 3D flow's axial vorticity clearly plays an important role in transporting the momentum. Or streamwise vorticity. Now in 3D, it's dead, right? So what you see, you know, it looks maybe similar in many ways, but you know, physics is completely different. Now, I did struggle quite a bit with sort of how do you really think about where, can you think about this sort of in the standard language about, can you think about the structure of that localized solution as some sort of transient amplification of disturbances, right? And you know, you talked about the fluid passing through the interface. So you know, in your case, you can think about an instability that basically feeds on the laminar profile, right? But it's effectively an instability. You have a perfect laminar flow, and there's no seed of a disturbance in the laminar. You need some sort of instability. So how you think about that instability, where the disturbance is really coming from, is a non-trivial aspect, non-trivial problem, because you do indeed have in the reference frame of that solution, you do have some of the fluid that's coming in from the upstream part, that's all the central line. Some of it is actually near the walls that's being dragged from the other side. So essentially you're feeding in your path from both sides by disturbances, right? Very different kinds of disturbances. But there's also another aspect that nobody's really talking about, and I'm not sure that we really sort of understand the problem well enough to sort of completely forget about pressure. Because in your model, for instance, like you don't have pressure, if you complete an overall, right? So it's just velocity and some form of vorticity or turbulence that interact with each other. But pressure really plays no role whatsoever. It's not obvious to me that we can really think about the problem in an entirely local sense, because pressure tends to couple things in a non-local way, right?
Yeah, so, well, when we looked at it, at least in plain fluid flow, just to say that, we could see we can find no contributions to the turbulence, to the localization of the components. You can look at the balance that's going on, and you can find no meaningful contribution to the pressure term to maintain the maintenance of those structures.
That's a different story. So do we understand why that is the case? Because that's not a thing. It's not trivial observation. I'm not saying that it should contribute. I'm just saying that.
There's a long history. I mean, I think at one point it was assumed that pressure was the dominant mechanism at work in this. The early explanations of Cole's experiment were had to do with pressure, that the turbulence generated a pressure field, which didn't touch with the ionization. But that you can do the calculations would seem to indicate that's not the case. So, I mean, I don't have an explanation for why any of these things are the way they are. I'm just saying that. I mean, that at that level of detail, I don't have an explanation.
So, for instance, when Mark talked about at the conference about doing linearization to describe the tails, he basically said, let's use the same exponential ansatz for velocity and pressure.
The pressure doesn't play a role at all. You can just, you have a model with pressure inside, a model without pressure, and the results are indistinguishable. And you can look at the value of the term.
Say it again, if you...
We have a model which takes the whole linearized lattice talks of the interface, and a model which drops lots of terms, including the pressure, they are indistinguishable in the decay rates and the shape of the interface.
But you cannot take away pressure completely because that's continuity. If you take away the pressure, then continuity disappears and your equation goes simpler.
You can take one component then of your equation, and what that will do, I think, and then we recover.
What is called the fast pressure, which is the linear part that has to be there. Otherwise, there is no continuity.
But we can do computations. Say you drop all the pressure terms. You take the you solve one for one component or two of the Navier-Stokes, and then recover the third one out of this, and that gives us exactly the same results of doing the computation with pressure.
What
even if it cannot be done.
It cannot be done.
Sure, but it gives the same result. I'm just saying that.
So the question is why that actually works.
Well, okay.
It'd be helpful to understand.
Sure. It would also be helpful to understand the shape of it, because it's really difficult. These are very cool.
I mean, is it the general result? Is it always true? Right? So the fact that you've shown that a particular solution is helpful, but it doesn't really prove that that's the general statement.
Yeah, but I'm not interested in such a general proof, because I don't know. It probably doesn't exist, but it's an observation that things are local at these interfaces. That's something we have sort of observed with real turbulence and with coherent structures. And why that is so, I cannot.
It's just an observation. I don't know too much about the laminar turbulent fronts, but if you just go back to the very basic story of how these structures sustain themselves, vortex wave interaction and the self-sustaining process, the pressure doesn't play any roles. Streaks and rolls. 3D instability.
No, you need pressure to maintain continuity. That's
Of course. Mechanistically, the pressure doesn't, aside from
continuity. Nobody talks about a dynamical role for pressure in this basic nonlinear mechanism that sustains the whole thing.
No, Mike,
and I'm only observing that maybe that's the case here as well.
What you're saying is that people talk about wave vortex interaction because we only look at velocities. We never look at pressures. So, you know, if you completely omit the pressure from the pictures, then of course it never showed up in the discussion. So the interpretation of the solutions that you see does not involve pressure. But that doesn't mean that pressure is not important or doesn't play a role in the mechanism.
If you look at the magnitude of the terms, you really see that it's ridiculously small compared to the dominant terms. Observation.
So, well, look, I mean, continuity, continuity tells you that if you have you know, upwellings and downwellings, then you're going to get vortices. Right? That's what continuity will tell you that. Maybe that's its role. Its role is in the roles, maybe. You know,
but that's relatively local.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point.
This might seem like a heresy, but does anybody else is using lattice Boltzmann? Because there you have completely different terms, and you have a state compressibility.
I don't think it should make any difference whether you use lattice Boltzmann or not. Lattice Boltzmann, you still want it to give you Navier-Stokes dynamics in these regimes. People have played with mesoscopic methods like that get the same thing.
They compare the compressibility a bit more there. That's a long question.
The problem with lattice Boltzmann, the compressibility effects are a completely different timescale. It's the sound waves, right? So that actually is a problem for the lattice Boltzmann people because they have to take tiny time steps to resolve sound waves or make the density artificially low, the compressibility artificially high, so you don't have such timescale separation.
Yes, that was a question related to the role of pressure. Because there you can probably play more than the compressible Navier-Stokes. That was what I was asking.
Okay, well, look, it's 14:30, so I think we should adjourn. Thank everyone for the discussion.
Thank you, Dwight, for organizing. Thank you.